Okay, thank you. Yeah, thanks to the organisers for the invitation. I should say as well, the parts of this are joint work, I guess, principally with Hugh Blackburn, Spencer Sherwin, and mostly Kengo Deguchi, who I think was here earlier. And rather than talk about one particular problem in detail and give you all the messy asymptotic details, I'll just try and summarise the key results from different papers over the last few years. So what I'm going to talk about is coherent structures in the limit of R tends to infinity. And the immediate question is why. A lot of people believe that you can do almost everything by computation these days, and that maybe there's no room for any kind of asymptotic or theoretical work. I see it quite differently. I think that the advent of massive computational resources maybe has opened up or shown the need for more theory, in fact. And I believe that by looking at structures when the Reynolds number goes to infinity, you actually gain incredible insight as to what's going on at finite Reynolds numbers. I think I'll try and prove that to you with one or two of the slides. And the main reason is I enjoy doing it, okay? Let's be honest. At my age, you should do what you enjoy, okay? Stop worrying about people who give you money. And just enjoy it. Okay, so I'll talk about what I think are the two canonical non-localized exact coherent structures for arbitrary shear flows. And I'm going to refer to one as a vortex wave interaction state, and the other as a free stream coherent structure. And then I'll talk about how certain canonical states emerge from these two particular structures, or the vortex wave interaction state in particular, and I'll start to construct new families of solutions which I think have remarkable properties. And I'll show how one particular generalisation leads naturally to the local form. Okay, so let's talk about two structures. I'll call the first one vortex wave interaction states. Most of you guys will call them something else. Probably self-sustained processes or something else, but this work goes back to 1991 with Frank Smith. We were interested in boundary layer transition, and we developed a theory which enabled waves, rows and streaks to interact in a self-sustaining way, and we derived precise equations in the high Reynolds number limit which described that interaction. Unfortunately, it wasn't relevant to boundary layer transition, so we stopped working on it and started to do other things. The second type are called free stream coherent structures, and this came out of work with Kengo 2-3 years ago. But here I'm going to concentrate on the vortex wave interaction states. The type 2 free stream coherent structures are important, I believe, for various reasons, but the most recent work we've been doing shows that really, they act as a mechanism by which free stream turbulence can get from outside the boundary layer to the wall. People interested in transition on aeroplane wings and on aerofoils and wind tunnels, the key problem is how do you get something outside the boundary layer into the boundary layer to stimulate a disturbance. And it appears that free stream coherent structures play an absolutely vital role in that. Essentially, you can convert a very tiny disturbance in the free stream to something large at the wall. I'm not going to talk about localized states, but they can be thought of as variations on a theme. There's lots of interesting work on it, but I'm not going to go into it here. I think it's nice to say a little bit about the where this work comes from. The self-sustained process work sprung up from the work of Walef in the 90s and 2000s. The vortex wave stuff really owes its origin to work on steady streaming by Trevor Stewart, Schlichting in Germany, and to Dave Benny's long wave, short wave theories for wave interactions. Basically, if you have something operating on two scales, you can have a resonance between them where basically they reinforce each other. And wave vortex is actually, I think of now as really just being a steady streaming problem where you have a wave trapped in a waveguide, which is a critical layer, and this thing sloshing backwards and forwards generates a mean flow. And also, it's related to the generalised Lagrangian mean work of Andrews and McIntyre, but I've never been able to understand the paper enough to compare it. But clearly the key ideas are present in that paper, and it's usually overlooked. Okay, just one picture on free stream coherent structures. So this is for an asymptotic structure and boundary layer, so y is vertical. So the streamlines velocity in this direction would be just 1 minus e to minus y. The picture on the left is the streak induced by an exact coherent structure, and you see that that is localized near the wall. The roll associated with the disturbance is sitting in the free stream, and the Reynolds stresses associated with the wave part of the flow also concentrate in the free stream. So this is rather a curious animal. It's a fully nonlinear interaction.
Question?
Mm-hmm.
What does the coherent structure that is originating these look like?
Well, it's...
Is it just a vortex?
No, it's a roll, a streak, and a wave, okay? But it's different than the vortex-wave interaction or the reduced modelling, that the all the waves are of comparable size. It's not just one fundamental in the streamlined direction. You can't decouple the roll, streak, and wave. They're all present, but you can't pick them apart and write down separate equations.
So these aren't one of the particular exact coherent solutions. These are your type 2 solutions.
These are the type 2, yeah. Okay. And the interaction sits in the free stream. So right at the edge of the boundary layer, distance log out from the wall, you can write down what I think is actually a beautiful nonlinear eigenvalue problem.
What is the edge of the boundary layer? I mean, the laminar boundary layer is at 1. That's the total and 1, but these Reynolds numbers is maybe at 100. So this sits somewhere in between. Which sense do you call it the boundary?
Well, the basic flow is 1 minus e to minus y, okay, for a asymptotic suction laminar boundary layer.
Yeah.
So yeah.
One.
No, this is, y is up here, okay, so this is about at 10 or something.
Yeah.
And this is at a particular Reynolds number, okay? And if I convert that into, I can't remember what a Reynolds number is, but it's basically scales like log r. So they sit at the edge, they're a distance log r from the wall.
Well, we did these calculations, and the boundary layer, sort of this, if you look at sort of the total fluctuations, which is very, very high up in height.
Yeah.
And when it's numbers of, say, 1,000, you easily have a height of 100.
It depends how you define the Reynolds number. I think it's probably...
If I stick to the same Reynolds numbers, the height is very high, and these structures sit at a height of 10. And so in that sense, they're not at the boundary.
The asymptotic suction boundary layer is 1 minus e to minus y, okay?
That's on a scale of 1, fine.
Yeah. And these...
The fluctuations around it reach much higher.
Yeah, but no, I'm not talking about... I'm talking about exact solutions of the equations. Laminar solutions. Nonlinear exact coherent structures.
That's okay. But you said that we're sitting at the boundary of the boundary layer.
At the edge of the boundary layer.
Of the laminar.
Yeah.
At which the scale would be 1. But you say they go much further out.
Well, okay, the edge. A distance log out from the wall. Okay. If it's a growing boundary, it's square root of log out. Okay. But the key thing is that there's a non-interaction sitting out here, away from the wall, which throws off a growing streak, which amplifies as you get nearer to the wall. So you have a tiny interaction in the free stream, which generates a large amplitude near-wall streak. What I think is incredible about this structure, though, is that we discovered it first for an asymptotic suction boundary layer, but it actually applies to any two-dimensional boundary layer. Almost all three-dimensional boundary layers, it applies to vortex sheets. Basically, if you ever have a flow where you change from essentially one value to another value through an exponential term, this structure arises. And it's exactly the same canonical nonlinear eigenvalue problem every time. you can account for boundary layer growth. If the boundary layer is growing, then basically these structures switch on and off as the local wave numbers vary as you go downstream. But it's the same structure. Also, it's not actually just a phenomenon which occurs in boundary layers. If you look at pipe flow, for example, then there is a mode at the centre of the pipe, okay, which basically mimics this structure. You get an interaction right at the centre in a relative to minus a quarter layer, where you generate a large amplitude streak which fills the pipe. And I think Mike has similar structures in channel flow. Okay, let's talk about vortex wave states and vortex wave interaction states. So the formal description was given by myself and Frank in a series of papers, and then Spencer applied it to Couette flow. And the beauty of the reduction associated with the asymptotics is that you start off with 3D time-dependent Navier-Stokes, and you produce basically 2D, a 2D steady Navier-Stokes problem coupled with an anti-Petrian diffusion equation coupled with an inviscid eigenvalue problem. So it's a massive reduction. You take the Reynolds number out of the problem and you get precise scalings for the different flow quantities. And this is kind of cartoon then. We have a streak, so we have a roll in this plane and a flow in this direction, which is periodic across here. We add a wave on top of this, so it propagates downstream or into the wall. It's an inviscid wave, so where its local wave speed coincides with the streamized velocity, you get a critical layer of Reynolds number to minus one third. So when the wave reaches this layer, it amplifies. It gets bigger by a factor of Reynolds number to minus a third, Reynolds number to plus one third. And you have a critical layer to deal with, but it's actually a viscous critical layer, so it stays linear. That's the key simplification of the problem. The wave pressure as you approach the critical layer is interesting, though. The wave pressure, even though the equation for it is singular, has this expansion here, and you have a logarithmic term. N is the distance from the critical layer. You have a logarithmic jump when you cross the critical layer. And that's the kind of thing which I guess people not too familiar with critical layers think all the time, that whenever you cross the critical layer you have a log term and you get a jump, okay? That's not actually true. Okay. If the critical layer is flat, the coefficient in front of this is actually zero. It's much more subtle than... It goes back to the kind of classical work on critical layers 30, 40 years ago, where people... prove that you get a pi phase jump as you cross the critical layer, but that's only for certain kinds of critical layers. It's not a general result. Okay, so if you take Navier-Stokes in this form here, then there are three timescales for vortex wave interaction. There's the usual slow diffusion timescale on which the roll streak part of the flow lives. There's RT, which is a fast inviscid time scale. So the wave propagates downstream with the speed of the basic flow, typically. But the flow, the roll streak flow, just on a longer time scale. But there's then an unexpected time scale sitting in between, Reynolds number to the half times t. So this sits midway between the slow diffusion time scale and the wave's time scale. And it's on this time scale that vortex wave interactions, self-sustained processes, live or die. And essentially it relates to what's happening in the critical layer. Okay, so a little bit of mathematics or asymptotics. The flow expands then as a streak of order 1, a roll of size 1 over r. You can trace those scalings back to G.I. Taylor in the 1920s. They've been rediscovered several times since. Then you have a wave of Reynolds number to minus 7/6 sitting on top of it. So this is an inviscid wave system riding on top of the roll streak flow. But the roll is small compared to the streak. So the wave basically just sees the streak and its stability properties are governed by the streak. So the thing propagates downstream with speed c. The rule just has a dependence on y, z, and t. So y is vertical, z is spanwise, and t is time. The wave lives on the faster time scale. There's a critical there for the wave when u is equal to the wave speed, and everything blows up like 1 over y minus f. Mm-hmm.
So your wave is in viscid, but then it's multiplied by the Reynolds number. So how does the viscosity play in there?
So the wave is in viscid. So if you simply write perturb the streak, okay, then you get the generalization of Rayleigh's equation to two dimensions, okay? But the equation is singular at the critical layer. So once you reach the critical layer, the solution blows up like 1 over distance. You have to bring viscosity back in then to regularize it. And it's in that layer where you actually generate the roll flow.
So that's what this r to the minus 7 over 6 does? It's a regularization term?
No. This is, you adjust the size of the wave, okay?
Okay.
Such that when the wave interacts with itself, it gives you a jump in the roll flow of the same order here. So you just sit down with the expansions, okay? You let the wave interact with itself, you find out the effect it has on the roll flow, and you just increase its size until, lo and behold, it reinforces this. So that's the kind of key scaling. Okay, let me speed up a little. As the roll streak problem is 3D Navier-Stokes, with no x dependence.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I got another question about the previous slide.
Mm-hmm.
So is when you do the asymptotics, is it an asymptotic matching problem? So what, how do you match the outer expansion? How does that work?
So I have... I have a viscous critical, okay? I solve for the wave inside there, okay? Then I look at the squared terms, okay? The Rank stress terms.
Yeah.
And then inside this layer, I get a equation for the streak. I look at the outer forms it comes out, and what it tells me is that it produces a stress jump for the outer roll flow.
I see.
So it's kind of messy, but it's not.
Right.
It's not rocket science.
Right.
Okay, so the roll streak problem is Navier-Stokes without any x dependence. The roll equations decouple from the streak. But at the critical layer, you have a jump in the stress induced by the wave, okay? So it's actually a function of mod of the wave pressure squared. So the wave pressure satisfies this inviscid eigenvalue problem, generalization of Rayleigh's equation. This blows up when I hit the critical layer. I then solve exactly in the critical layer, and it tells me that the interaction there produces this jump. Okay, so this is, if you like, self-sustained processes, vortex wave interaction in one slide. Okay, you have a wave riding on top of a basic flow u of y z. Okay, the wave becomes singular inside the critical layer, interacts with itself to drive the VW part of the roll streak equations, but then the roll couples with the streak, and then the streak is unstable to the wave, and so you have this exact or nice analytical form for the interaction. Okay, and the wave equation you see looks linear, but of course it's not, because U is driven by the roll, which is driven by the wave. So it looks nice and linear, but it's actually not easy to solve. Solutions look like this. If you plot the drag associated with some of these states as a function of alpha, then you get a lower branch and an upper branch. The crosses correspond to Reynolds numbers of 10,000. If you follow the upper branch, you have to go to much higher Reynolds numbers before you get convergence. Okay, so basically you get... this would be for, I guess, EQ1 in John's notation. There are other modes as well, but what's interesting is that this saddle node point here, for all the different modes in the problem, stays pretty much around here. And this position correlates well with the minimum box size which the DNS people find for to sustain turbulence.
Phil, that R, which is nominally gone from your problem, what is...
No, okay, so I'm plotting here. So the continuous curve is the vortex wave solution with no Reynolds number n. And then I'm plotting the results for Reynolds number 10,000.
Can I ask a question? You said that this alpha is the same for all coherent structures?
No, you get a saddle node point, okay, for different ones. Actually, some of them can bifurcate from that curve, okay. But I think typically the alpha where you get the cutoff and the turnaround is pretty much not constant, but there's no great variations.
And no great variation in the asymptotics is what, the factor of 2 or 3? Because we've looked at the bifurcation points in Taylor Gwett flow are known and they vary between 120 for the first one to.
We've maybe looked at 3, 4, and they're probably maybe 10%, 15% difference, not huge differences. Okay, so these are the kind of pictures you get then. So these are finite Reynolds numbers calculation to tell you whether or not the asymptotics is describing the story. These are three different positions on the lower branch. These are contours of constant streamwise velocity. So this is the streak. This line is the critical layer, and here I've plotted the Reynolds stresses. It's the stresses associated with wave which drive the interaction, and you see they're concentrated inside the critical layer. So this interaction generates the jump, the stress jump for the roll. As I go further to the left, we see that it's kind of diffusing outwards. At smaller wave numbers, then different effects start to come in.
So these are just the Reynolds stresses for your second equation?
No, I've now gone to Navier-Stokes, okay? I'm plotting Navier-Stokes results in order to see if it's giving me the same results as the theory, okay? And so these are the Reynolds stresses, the U.
For the whole Reynolds stresses?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's concentrated inside the critical layer. The upper branch is different. If I start off near the saddle node point, it's much the same. The critical layer becomes inflected. The Reynolds stresses are concentrated in here. But as you go further to the left, then some exotic structures appear. Okay, you get the Reynolds stresses larger away from the critical layer. And that's a completely different story, but it can be described asymptotically, but there's not time here. Okay, so how does this relate to the computational approach? So we have the solutions beginning as a saddle node point. As R increases, if we do the whole thing computationally, Wang and Wallace and John suggested the wave should scale like, or their calculations suggested the wave scaled like Reynolds number to minus 0.9. The theory says it's Reynolds number to minus 11/12, and that's pretty close to 0.9 if you want to work it out. If the critical layer is horizontal, flat, then it drops down to Reynolds number to minus 5/6. The streak, raw contours from the theory, pretty much identical to Navier-Stokes calculations. The vortex wave interaction describes all the lower and upper branch states for sufficiently high R, and it's even accurate down to Reynolds numbers of about 1,000. I like showing this picture. It's a comparison of Wang et al.'s results and the vortex wave interaction. So it's different flow properties with the roll, streak and wave. The dashes are the asymptotic theory. And you can see it's pretty much indistinguishable from the full numerical calculations, even down to Reynolds number 1,000. And in asymptotics, if you get a green light, this, you really feel as if all your birthdays have come at once. It's pretty unusual. Usually, if you're on the same page, you're happy. Okay, let me move into a higher gear now. What's the difference between lower and upper branch states? Essentially, the lower branch has one unstable eigenvalue. It's associated with what I call a fast mode, which lives on the Reynolds number to half-time scale. And it's a kind of cross between a Rayleigh mode and a slow mode. There are three kinds of instabilities, okay? The whole thing can meander backwards and forwards on the raw streak time scale. You can have a fast Rayleigh instability. And you can have the thing which sits in between. And I think it's interesting just to draw a picture which explains the difference between the lower and upper branch. The wave exists as an eigenvalue of the streak-inviscid instability problem. If you plot alpha against the growth rate of a disturbance, then you get a curve like this. Thanks, John. This is the typical of any really instability problem, okay? And this wave number here is the wave number of the neutral wave in the vortex wave interaction, okay? But of course, all these wave numbers over here are unstable. And that's why sometimes you get quite a good kick in when you talk about this subject, okay? Because most people carefully forget to mention that you actually have this whole band of unstable waves sitting in the background. In other words, if you halved the box size, the whole thing would be unstable. Okay, but when you go around the saddle node point, okay, first of all, if you continue this, it's interesting, you actually get that. It turns around and you get a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues. When you go around the upper branch, it actually looks like this. Okay? And now you have then, you see a real instability of the same wave number as the carrier wave. Okay, so the upper branch, you see, is catastrophically unstable. But also you have a complex conjugate pair of eigenvalues branching off here. Okay, and I'm not going to go into that. Basically, there is a complex conjugate pair which leads to a fast time periodic state, and there's a complex conjugate pair which leads to a slow time periodic state, and they relate to Kawahara and Kida's fast and slow modes for a quick flow.
Can I ask a question? I mean, if you take the EQ1 mode in plain quartz flow, you look at the upper branch, the typical bifurcation diagram in small domains is that you have a hot bifurcation where it picks up the first frequency, and then you have period doubling and all the other nice beauties. Which extent is that related?
The bifurcation is the Hopf bifurcation. One of the complex conjugate eigenvalue pair is the Hopf bifurcation, but we've not followed it beyond there. That's some more details about the time periodic bifurcations, but let me skip through that. Okay. So this was all for quiet flow in a channel. Okay. Quiet flow is interesting, but there aren't that many people in the world who really care about it. It's a nice problem, but it's not really of much practical importance, to be honest. So I thought it'd be nice to see what happens for much more general shear flows. But if you start off with quiet flow, this is work which was published 3 years ago with Blackburn and Spencer. We started off with a quiet flow problem, okay, and said, what would happen if we now take the wavelength of the structures just to shrink? Okay, so if you take the span-wise wave number and stream-wise wave number to go to zero and then rescale the problem, then lo and behold, you get now a canonical structure which is independent of the walls. Okay, in other words, if you write down the whole expansions in the limit of the wavelengths going to zero, then you find that the depth of the channel drops out of the leading order solution. So you produce canonical states for an arbitrary shear flow. But then, early last year, I started to think about how we could generalise that. Just focus on the top picture here, okay? This is the roll structure associated with a mirror symmetric, isolated canonical structure in an infinite shear flow. But now what I do is I put an infinite stack of these, okay? Obviously, if these things are sufficiently far apart, there's no interaction. Okay, but now suppose I start moving these things together. Okay, then I now go to a different configuration. Okay, I have an infinite set of periodic structures in the normal direction as well now. Okay, associated with each roll, there is going to be a wave which propagates in this direction with the speed of the streak at this different level. Okay? The rolls themselves are periodic in the normal direction because the waves, it's essentially the same wave but with just a different wave speed. So we use the wavelength in the y direction as the typical length for an arbitrary shear flow. We superimpose an infinite system of waves with wave speeds differing by an integer. Okay, so each wave has a different critical layer. But only the interaction of a wave with itself actually drives the flow, okay, because it blows up in its own critical layer. So you can really consider each wave to be independent. So you now get a raw streak flow, which is u is y plus u of yz, where u is now periodic in the vertical direction, and a raw flow, which is periodic in the vertical direction. Okay, so it's now quite a different structure completely, and we have an infinite set of waves driving this. The wave pressure is, again, size runs length of minus 5/6, but it now takes this kind of form here, e to the il alpha x, then a summation over n of e to the minus in alpha t times the wave pressure function, which just has its origin shifted. In other words, it's exactly the same wave, okay, but these are just stacked on top of each other in an infinite array. Okay, but the pressure is not periodic in the vertical direction. If you look at the expansion, then you can see easily the pressure is just, if you go from one position to the next position, the height one above, then the pressure is just multiplied by e to the minus in alpha t. But it's the modulus of the pressure squared which drives the interaction. So this, the modulus of this squared, is constant. So that's why you generate a periodic raw structure. Okay, but then there's also something interesting hiding in the expansion for the pressure, and that is the following. We have an infinite system of waves, okay, at these different levels, okay, all travelling downstream with a wave speed differing by 1. But suppose I work out the pressure at a given x, y and z, okay, it's now a periodic function of time. It's not a stationary solution at all. So you get contributions to the pressure at a point from all the waves, okay? So it's actually a time-periodic solution of the full equations of motion now, but it's basically generated by this infinite stack of interactions. And the timescale is comparable with the Kawahara key to fast time-periodic mode. Okay, the mathematical, or the computational part of it is quite easy. The only case we've got, or I've got numbers for yet, is the mirror symmetric mode. The nice thing about this problem is that the mirror symmetric mode is easy enough for me to compute, okay, in the sense that you have a critical layer, but it's a regular singular point. And that means that you don't have to bring in viscosity to regularize the problem. So you can actually solve the problem independent of Reynolds number. The wave pressure problem stays the same, okay, but it's now on minus infinity to infinity. So you get the same generalization of Rayleigh's equation, the divergence of grad p over u plus y squared is zero, but p has to go to zero at both ends. Okay, the pressure equation is singular at the critical layer again, but you can get through without viscosity. Okay, so this is some results then for a particular alpha beta down here. This is over just one vertical wavelength, so this is the streak part of the flow, driven by it's just a mirror symmetric mode, and this is the wave pressure. So the wave pressure is a subharmonic. I guess it's EQ7 in your notation, John, is it? But these are now for infinite regions. So you see, we have a solution of the full equations now, which is periodic in the normal direction. It's periodic in time and periodic in the other two directions as well. If you look at the pressure as a function of y is horizontal, these are the pressure eigenfunctions associated with the waves at the different critical layers. Okay, so it's exactly the same function, just stacked up at different heights. Well, now we can do what Blackburn and I did for the quiet flow problem, and you can extend it to an arbitrary shear flow. And that's where it gets really interesting. So rather than perturb around a linear profile y, you can apply this to an arbitrary shear flow. Here you have to use a phase equation approach, because you have slow variations in the vertical spanwise and the time directions, so you get an iconal equation, a leading order, and then an amplitude equation. But the key result is that the consistent of the expansion now actually tells you what the basic flow has to be. It's like mean field theory or Gödel vortex theory, okay? You can actually have a wave system or disturbance system so big that it actually determines the mean flow. Okay? So in other words, these structures can only exist in an arbitrary shear flow if the arbitrary shear flow has the law of the wall as its profile, which I think is quite remarkable. Without going into all the WKB phase equation analysis, you can see from the equations and from a kind of similarity argument as well, if the canonical structure is going to be repeated at every position in a shear flow, you need the local wavelength has to vary like the distance from the wall. So in other words, which means that the derivative with respect to distance from the wall has to be like 1 over y, so you get the logarithmic profile. Okay, but this comes out of the phase equation approach when I write down the evolution equation for the amplitude at second order. Okay, and that structure is actually similar to what I did years ago for Gödel vortices and curved flows. So I think this new canonical structure is interesting. It starts off in quet flow. It generalizes to an arbitrary shear flow, but it can only exist in an arbitrary shear flow if the shear flow actually has a logarithmic profile. I think that's a good point to stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? More questions? Nobody likes
so. Yeah, your last result here is very interesting. So what happens with the scales of the rolls and streaks? So you have the logarithmic mean profile
and basically it scales on distance from the wall.
Scales on distance from the wall.
Yeah. So the iconal equation gives you the y dependence of the wavelengths as you go away from the wall.
So you can have coexisting structures, coexisting vortex wave interactions.
Yeah.
So I guess what I want to understand a little better is what is the structure of the whole solution that comes out here?
Okay. So if you start off with quet flow, have this infinite.
No.
Okay. But when it goes to the arbitrary shear flow, then basically locally it's exactly like that. But as it goes throughout the flow, the local wavelengths and wave speeds change. But there are different solutions of the kind of quet flow infinite periodic problem. And so what I'm saying is, if I insist that one stays or persists throughout the whole fluid, then I get the law of the wall. You could have other ones which intersected. So, I mean, there would be no universal constant in front of the logarithm, okay? It would be a weak function of the wave numbers of the problem. And I've spent 4 months trying to calculate it unsuccessfully.
Huh? So it was unfortunate you weren't at the conference bit, because one of the big themes of the conference, particularly from the people who have data, is how important Townsend's attached eddy hypothesis is and these sort of superstructures that you see. That they're there if you look for them. Mm-hmm. And I have no coherent question here really, but I wonder if that can be interpreted in terms, you know, you're starting to move away from just looking at one critical layer, there's lots of critical layers scaling with the distance from the wall. Is there some connection that we're groping towards between the VWI viewpoint and the attached eddy?
I don't know, it's the honest answer. Okay. But what I'm saying is that if this is relevant to turbulence, okay, you imagine a turbulent flow has this kind of slowly varying structure with these vortex wave interactions, okay. The wall isn't driving the fact that you get a logarithmic profile, okay. These things can only exist if you have the law of the wall, okay. But the wall comes in as a kind of secondary effect because of the distance. Because of the distance scaled equations.
Maybe I need to look at the videos again, but that sounds like the sort of things that Joe Kowicki and Ivan Marisic were saying.
And Beverly as well. That's right, absolutely.
That's what they're saying, you know, exactly that argument that you don't need the wall, it just gives you the law of the wall, and then you see this, and then you're mathematically describing an aspect of the elephant in a different way.
I mean, it appears that the law of the wall has nothing to do with the wall, if you like.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Harvey would probably disagree with that.
The technical level, I mean, what is similar in their approach to yours is that you're taking a structure, then you're repeating it in height, but you're maintaining sort of the length scale and everything to go with it, you're adjusting the phase scale.
No, the length scales and phase speed all have to change as you go throughout the floor.
Okay, so you maintain that, and then you adjust the speed in steps of one.
For the linear shear, okay, yeah. Then the speed goes in steps of one. Okay. When you go to a WKB formulation, you have this kind of profile now, but you zero in on some little region, okay, and then it just looks like the quet. Okay, so they have difference in the first speeds of just one as you go up in steps. But then as you move throughout the floor, that changes slowly.
Have you actually calculated these velocity fields, or you simply assume that these velocity fields have a certain structure and then you impose sort of this diagram?
I've calculated them. Okay.
You can or you cannot?
Sorry?
You cannot. I mean,
cannot what?
Calculate. Well,
I have calculated them.
You can't.
Yeah. I mean, the picture was from calculations, yeah.
Even this stack solution? In the log profile?
No. I've done it for the quet flow, okay. And that, see, the general profile is exactly the same locally. You get the same eigenvalue problem, if you like, as you do for the infinite shear, okay. But then the connection, as you go to different levels, comes from the WKB next order. But locally, it looks exactly like
globally, I mean, how you put it together, I mean, that's the.
Well, you get an evolution equation. You get an icon equation for the wavelengths and waves and phase speed as you go upwards, okay? And then at next order, you get the amplitude sitting out in front, okay? But the consistency of it then gives you the velocity profile has to come from the law of the wall.
Is it critical at all that you have a discrete set of layers, or can you get to a continuous solution from there, putting them together?
Discrete is probably simpler.
Well, sure.
I think it has to be discrete because, I mean, self-sustained processes or vortex wave interactions, I prefer to call it, depends crucially on this kind of separation between wave roll and streak. Okay, if, in a sense, everything is merged into a continuum, you don't get the separation of scales. And maybe the real fluid does that, okay, but you can't describe it from the asymptotics. But I would argue you can't describe it from the numerics either. So you're just doing a different discrete problem too.
Oh, okay. No, when you do numerics, your discreteness is at the order of length. It's much smaller than that.
Well, one of round number can be as small as you like, can't it?
what is the jump that you put in there? I mean, when you're doing the log layer, how do you decide that I'm going to be putting layers at a given distance? Is there a distance? Is there a quantum there, or what?
You have a scale for the. I mean, there is a wave. You assume some wavelength of the period is in the vertical direction. Okay, but it has to be small compared to the variation of the logarithmic profile. Okay.
Something that you assume, or something that.
You assume a scale for it such that the Reynolds number is large. I mean, if the Reynolds number wasn't large for this, I mean, the length scale is the local depth over which you're kind of stacking these things, okay? So you choose that, okay? But you choose it such that then the Reynolds number associated with that length scale, you know, so you take the local shear and that depth to form a Reynolds number, and you assume that that is high, large.
That's your Kolmogorov of length, basically.
Yeah.
Continue. I mean, from the point of view of
It depends how you look at it, hasn't it?
All right. Any more questions?
I mean, that's completely different from Kawiki. I mean, Kawiki was speaking of things that were art, microscopic. That's completely different from that.
Thank you very much.